Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They always started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor.
Welcome to this week's installment of Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. Today is Sunday, June 30th, 2013. In recent times, I've started doing two broadcasts every week. I'll typically do one broadcast that's a little bit longer and that deals with more highbrow, more theoretical issues and questions, and then I'll do a shorter broadcast that deals with contemporary events and current affairs and current news and that kind of thing. Some of my more recent broadcasts have been in that vein. We also had a roundtable discussion last week with a couple of our colleagues, a couple of our senior editors at Attack the System, Michael Parrish and Vince Reinhart, and I plan on bringing some of our other co-editors on at various points in the future. But this week, I'm going to consolidate everything into one program because I really think that with some of the things that have happened this week, I could really do one singular program that deals with both current events and with their broader theoretical and historical and political implications. So that's what I'm going to do this week. Now, the big thing that happened this week that lots of people have been talking about and that has been in the news quite a bit are the Supreme Court rulings involving the very controversial issue of same-sex marriage. That is what's been in the media. That's what's been on the minds of a lot of people who follow these kinds of things. One of my other co-editors at Attack the System mentioned that even at work and in, you know, ordinary workplaces and cafes and bars, you know, ordinary people even are talking about this question of same-sex marriage and these Supreme Court rulings. And so I want to talk a little bit about this, about it, the significance of this issue and related issues. Now, to really put this into some kind of perspective, to put these Supreme Court rulings that happened concerning same-sex marriage, there were two of them, one of them involving the federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act, that was struck down by the Supreme Court, the other one involving Proposition 8, which was a referendum that it passed in California barring same-sex marriage that was invalidated by state courts, and then then that was affirmed by the Supreme Court as well this week. But if we want to put these rulings in some serious historical context or serious political context, I think it's first necessary to go back and look at the whole history of the Supreme Court and its role in shaping law in the United States. Now, from the time that the Constitution was first created, the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Union of States was first created in the late 18th century, up through around the mid-20th century. So we're talking about roughly the first 150 years of the existence of the United States, up until about 60 or so, 65 years ago. During that time, the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary generally were essentially the legal arm of the state, of the business class, of the traditional WASP elite, and of the WASP culture generally. If you look at all of the Supreme Court cases, all of the landmark or most important Supreme Court cases from the 19th century on into the early 20th century, you see that almost always the federal courts are upholding the interest of the establishment. I remember reading once where it was something like 100 years after the Bill of Rights was first ratified, that the Supreme Court actually upheld a single case involving the right of free speech. That the that the Supreme Court upheld a case where someone was claimed they had been denied their right to free speech. So Even though these rights that are written into the Bill of Rights and into the U.S. Constitution were put in place way back in the late 18th century, the courts, certainly not the federal courts and really not the state courts either, never really took them particularly seriously in any way until about a century or so later. And if you go back and you look at Supreme Court decisions from the 19th and early 20th century, you see that. For example, some of the more well-known cases are there was the Dred Scott case, which upheld, this was a pre-Civil War case that upheld the constitutionality of slavery. There was the Lochner case from the 1870s that struck down workers' rights in the sense of limiting the number of hours that employers could require a worker to be on the job. There was the Buck v. Bell case from the World War I era, which upheld the right of the state to forcibly sterilize people that were judged to be defective. There was also a case in the during the World War II era in the 1940s where the Supreme Court upheld the right of the government to incarcerate people of Japanese ancestry en masse. That would be, what was going on, of course, was the Second World War, and people of Japanese ancestry in the United States were rounded up and put in detention centers. And that would be the right of the government to do that was upheld by the Supreme Court in the 1940s. And of course, that something like that would probably be unthinkable today. For example, if, let's say in the name of fighting the war on terrorism, the government said, well, we're just going to round up everyone of Arab ancestry, everyone of Muslim faith, and put them in detention centers. That would probably, at the very least, provoke a very extreme outcry, and I really think it's very unlikely that any American court today would uphold something like that. But the reason I bring up all these examples is to show that throughout the most of the history of the United States, the Supreme Court, the federal courts, were very much on the side of the state, of the business class, of the traditional WASP elite, and of the dominant WASP culture anytime cases like that came up. There was no doubt about it. Now, where that started to change was in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the Supreme Court started to take a more liberal turn, and the reason for that was, there were a number of reasons, but some of it was just changes in the culture and changes in society and so forth, but on a more concrete level, the reason for it was that the courts, the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, came to be dominated by judges and justices that were products of the New Deal era, or were products of the older progressive era. And they brought with them to the judiciary, to the court, a set of values that were somewhat more leftward leaning or more liberal leaning than what the previous courts would have reflected. Not to say that these new wave of Supreme Court justices or federal judges were liberal or leftist by today's standards. That wasn't really the case at all. But you did find a leftward shift in the Supreme Court starting in the 1950s, and some of that had to do with the appointment of Earl Warren to the Supreme Court. He was a Supreme Court justice back during the 1950s, 1960s. He wrote a lot of landmark liberal opinions involving some of the well-known cases for that time period. And it made him very unpopular with a lot of traditional conservatives. For example, in the county that I grew up in, I'm not old enough to remember this, but people have told me that in the county that I grew up in the late 1960s, there was a billboard on one of the main highways that said, "Impeach Earl Warren." So it's not that the decisions made by the more liberal-oriented Supreme Court that emerged in the 50s and 60s were always popular, but there was this kind of ideological shift in court rulings during that time, and the reason for that was, like I said, there was a change in personnel where you had more and more judges that had come out of the New Deal paradigm, had come out of the progressive era, that had been appointed by presidents who were liberals for their time, like, say, Franklin Roosevelt or whomever. Although Earl Warren himself was appointed by Eisenhower, who was a Republican, although a somewhat liberal Republican by by contemporary standards in terms of the way we think of Republicans today. But it was so during the 1950s, starting in the 1950s, we start to see a wave of Supreme Court decisions that expand the realm of rights and liberties for individuals, for traditionally subordinated groups in society, whether racial minorities, workers, women, and so forth. We start to see a series of decisions that are more favorable to more marginalized population groups, and there are, that are also more sympathetic to groups that may come in contact with into conflict with business interests, for instance, like labor unions or consumer rights, consumer interest groups, and then later environmental groups and all of that. So we do see this paradigm shift where the in the 50s and 60s, where the court is not so much firmly on the side of the traditional WASP elite, the traditional business class, and the state. There's more nuance that's introduced into the process. Some of the more well-known cases, of course, are the ones involving race. For example, in 1954, there was the Supreme Court decision Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education, which outlawed racial segregation in schools. There were also some of the cases involving religion that were very unpopular among a lot of people. For example, there were some cases that removed compulsory prayer, Bible study, things like that from public school systems. For my parents, who are now older people, in their late 70s, have told me that when they were growing up in the public schools, it was unquestioned that you had prayer, Bible reading, those kinds of things, and that was the norm. But there were Supreme Court decisions that said that this infringes on the rights of religious minorities, Jewish people, atheists, and so forth. So some of those were removed. Another change that came out of this time was an expansion of the rights of the accused, people accused of crimes, and the rights of citizens in encounters with police. For example, prior to 1967, the police were not required to inform you of your rights upon arrest. It was the so-called Miranda rights. For example, on every TV show, every crime show, you see the cops arresting somebody and they say you have the right to remain silent. Yeah. The police were not required to do that prior to 1967. It was up to you to know your rights. Also, prior to the 1960s, the courts were not required to provide you with a public defender if you could not afford an attorney. You were basically on your own if you couldn't afford a private attorney. Another ruling that came out of the 1960s was the exclusionary rule. That was rooted in a case called Mapp versus Ohio, where it was determined by the courts that evidence acquired by the police during the course of a criminal investigation could not be introduced in court if it was obtained by illegal means, such as a violation of the Fourth Amendment prohibition against searches and seizures. And of course, this is how the courts during that time started to develop a reputation as being the friends of criminals and so forth. A lot of these changes were lamented by a lot of people, particularly conservatives, who said that, well, these are just get out of jail free cards, and the courts have ruled in favor of the criminal suspects and so forth. But without getting into the political arguments involved, these were some of the landmark cases. There were a lot of other cases of this type that happened during the 50s, the 60s, and on into the early 70s. Another one, of course, is the one that's probably the most famous, and that's Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision in 1973 that legalized abortion nationwide, that struck down all the state laws barring abortion. And that decision was actually rooted in a previous decision from 1967 that struck down anti-birth control laws. There was a decision called Griswold versus Connecticut that took place in 1967 struck down state laws barring birth control, the sale of birth control devices. Other cases involved sexually explicit literature. There's some the landmark Supreme Court case involving the right to read or distribute sexually explicit literature is the Miller case, which I think is a 1974 decision. But prior to this time, a lot of pornographic material and of the kind that we see even in mainstream bookstores or all over the internet today would have been illegal, in the same way that something like drugs or prostitution or something like that is legal today, is illegal today. So there were a lot of Supreme Court decisions, a long list, I mean, too many for me to go over in this program, from the 1950s up through the early 1970s that greatly expanded the rights of individuals, the rights of traditionally excluded or subordinated groups in society, you know, everyone from prison inmates to racial minorities to gay people, women, and lots of others, in lots of different areas of society, in lots of different areas of life. The Supreme Court also started taking a much more friendly view of environmental groups, of public interest groups that introduce class action suits against big corporations, of consumer rights groups, of labor, and all that. Now, the sharp leftward turn of the federal courts during this time, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, produced a serious backlash from the right. And what's interesting is that in the 1950s and 60s that you see the growth of a much more liberal judiciary, and in turn, of course, that reflected trends in the wider society. It reflects the cultural revolution that was taking place in the wider society that really, you know, saw some embryonic steps in the 50s, really started to explode in the mid to late 60s, started coming into full fruition in the 70s, and is more or less, you know, has progressed and institutionalized itself ever since then to the point where it's the status quo today. But at the same time that this leftward-oriented cultural revolution was taking place, another interesting phenomenon was going on, where there was also the growth of the post-war conservative movement. The so-called conservative movement, as it more or less exists today, has its roots in the conservative movement that grew up in the 1950s and was initially founded by thinkers like William F. Buckley and people like that, or at least those are the most prominent intellectuals associated with it. Now, but the post-war conservative movement had as its primary aims initially to roll back the New Deal and the welfare state generally. These were very much economic conservatives, very pro-business, staunch capitalists, very anti-welfare state. And also the other key issue was anti-communism, fighting the Cold War, increasing military spending. A few years ago, I had an article published at Tacky's Mag, the online webzine that's run by Tacky Theodore Coppolis. It's a paleoconservative / libertarian-oriented publication where I discussed the history of the post-war conservative movement. I was actually reviewing a book on that by Donald Critchlow. But what I argue is that the post-war conservative movement in the United States largely was an insurgency by elites in the Sun Belt, that during in the Sun Belt states in the South and West, you had the growth of an elite that was not attached to the old traditional Northeastern elite, a new Southern Western elite that was rooted in industries like oil and military production, armaments, and that kind of thing, and that this Sun Belt elite started to challenge the traditional Northeastern establishment for political dominance, and that the conservative movement that grew out of the 50s and 60s was largely the grassroots political arm of this Sun Belt elite that was challenging the Northern elite. The Sun Belt faction of the capitalist class was challenging the traditionally dominant Northeastern faction. And the conservative movement was largely its political arm. And out of this conservative movement, this post-war conservative movement, which attracted the sympathy of a great number of social conservatives of all different types, ranging from racial conservatives that opposed desegregation to religious conservatives that opposed Supreme Court rulings regarding prayer in school or abortion and things like that, so-called moral conservatives that opposed the sexual revolution and things of that type. You know, social and cultural conservatives of all different types tended to join forces with foreign policy and economic conservatives to oppose the cultural revolution that was taking place. And that was an interesting political realignment in and of itself, because it wasn't always the case that social conservatives and economic conservatives were on the same side. For example, during the era of classical American populism in the late 19th and early 20th century, you saw plenty of social conservatives who were enemies of things like big business. For example, William Jennings Bryan, who was probably most well known for being the guy who took the creationist side in the Scopes trial in the 1920s, was also something of a political and economic leftist, at least for his time. He was a religious conservative, a social conservative, but he also was the presidential candidate of the Populist Party, which was a left-wing minor party during that time. You know, very, very leftward-leaning, certainly by the standards of his time when it came to political and economic issues. So it wasn't always the case that social conservatives and economic conservatives were on the same side. But that paradigm, that alignment did emerge in the post-war conservative movement, as all of these groups, the military conservatives, foreign policy conservatives, economic conservatives, social, religious, moral, cultural, racial conservatives, all saw their interest aligning with each other, and their common interest was opposing the escalating cultural revolution that was starting to happen and did happen and started to become institutionalized in the United States and in Western civilization generally, but we're talking about American politics here for the time being. Now, one of the main things that the conservative movement of this time wanted to do was roll back the gains of the left in the judiciary. And for those of us like myself who grew up in the 70s and 80s, I grew up hearing conservatives bash the judiciary like crazy. And you still hear some of that. You still hear that. You still hear conservatives denouncing activist judges and things like that. And what they're really talking about are judges with more liberal views who do things like uphold the right to have an abortion or the rights of the accused in encounters with the police or things like that, or the right to same-sex marriage or whatever. Rolling back the gains of the left in the judiciary and in the realm of constitutional law was a big part of the conservative movement's agenda. In fact, you could argue that other than anti-communism, it was its primary agenda. And they had different reasons for holding these views. There were pro-business conservatives that didn't like the fact that the courts were starting to favor labor and consumer organizations and environmental groups and public interest groups and so forth. There were foreign policy military conservatives that didn't like the fact that certain court rulings were weakening the right of the government to conduct espionage. You had racial conservatives that objected to desegregation, and then after desegregation, things, other efforts to achieve racial integrationism, like anti-discrimination laws, and then later affirmative action and things like that. Of course, you had religious conservatives that objected to removal of prayer from public schools, and also things like expansion of abortion rights, birth control rights, free speech for pornographers and things of that nature. So the conservatives were very conscious about trying to roll back the gains of the left in the judiciary. And what they wanted to do, of course, was elect conservatives to offices that would then in turn appoint more conservative jurists to the federal judiciary and to the Supreme Court. And that was a big part of their campaign. I mean, even to this day, when conservative Republicans conduct electoral campaigns, that's one of their big things. They want to see more conservatives appointed to the judiciary. And to a large degree, they've been successful at that, because what you see is if you look at the history of the Supreme Court, you see that the Supreme Court takes a sharp liberal turn in the 50s, the 60s, and up to the early 70s. Then you start to see a rightward turn, a slight rightward turn in the 70s during the Richard Nixon era. Then it goes even more rightward during the Reagan era. And then it goes even more rightward during the George W. Bush era, to the point where today you have a Supreme Court that is dominated by a majority of conservatives, that is, and appointees of Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, and people who were probably more conservative than even the conservatives you would have found on previous Supreme Courts, maybe a generation earlier. So to a large degree, the conservative movement has been effective at having a greater number of conservatives appointed to the federal courts. And the interesting thing about that, though, is that it hasn't really produced the results that they wanted. Now, what the conservative movement wanted to do was roll back, they wanted to basically repeal virtually every Supreme Court decision from the 1950s to the 1970s. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but that's essentially what they wanted to a large degree, and that hasn't happened. What has happened is that the domination of the federal judiciary by conservatives has not reversed the cultural revolution of the 50s and 60s and 70s, but it has to some degree slowed down the process of institutionalization of that revolution. For instance, one big issue with social conservatives is, of course, abortion. And one of the main things that they've hoped to do with their, by getting more conservatives appointed to the Supreme Court was to repeal Roe versus Wade, or reverse the Roe versus Wade decision. But in 1992, there was a landmark Supreme Court decision involving abortion, a Supreme Court dominated by Republican appointees, where they actually upheld the right to abortion, although they gave the states somewhat more latitude in terms of regulating abortion. Likewise, in 2003, there was a Supreme Court decision repealing state laws barring or criminalizing same-sex relationships. Until 2003, about a third of the states still had, about a quarter to a third of the states still had laws on the books criminalizing so-called sodomy, meaning homosexual relationships. Those were rarely enforced, but those laws still were on the books, and the Supreme Court repealed those in 2003. So that case, Lawrence versus Texas, was basically the Roe versus Wade of gay rights. And that's, and this was in 2003, years after the Reagan administration had been in office, years after the George H.W. Bush administration had been in office. That was when George W. Bush himself was president. Now, those are just a couple of examples. So what we see is that the domination of the federal courts by conservatives has not produced the result that conservatives wanted. It hasn't reversed the Supreme Court, all the many landmark Supreme Court rulings of the 50s and 60s and 70s. It hasn't reversed the progress of the cultural revolution of the 60s and 70s. It's perhaps slowed it down a little bit, at least in the realm of law. I don't know that it slowed it down in other areas, but in the area of law, it's perhaps slowed it down slightly. At the same time, though, it's also true that individual judges are unpredictable. Like, for example, many people will point out that Anthony M. Kennedy, justice on the Supreme Court, was actually appointed by President Reagan, yet he's often been the decisive vote in some landmark liberal rulings concerning in a lot of Supreme Court cases, including some of the rulings this past week. So individual judges are unpredictable in terms of how they're going to vote in specific cases. Also, individual judges can change their opinions and change their ideologies over time. They can become more liberal, they can become more conservative. So while the conservative movement was successful in stacking the federal judiciary with Republican appointees, it hasn't produced the results they wanted. It hasn't repealed the Supreme Court decisions of the 50s and 60s and 70s. It hasn't rolled back the Cultural Revolution. It's perhaps slowed it down slightly in the legal realm, but that's about it. Now, one thing that figures prominently in this, and well, what all of this does, you know, what the changes that we see in the Supreme Court during the post-war era, the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s, the conservative backlash, the effort of conservatives to stack the judiciary with conservatives, what all of that did was create a scenario for the kind of showdown, the kind of cultural showdown that we saw this week in the Supreme Court over the issue of gay marriage. Because as all of these things were happening, as the Supreme Court was moving leftward and establishing all of these liberal precedents, and then as the wider society was undergoing a cultural revolution, and as there was a conservative backlash and somewhat successful efforts by conservatives to regain control of the courts, it's also true that the public perceptions of the question of homosexuality were starting to change significantly. Prior to the late 1960s, homosexuality was viewed as a form of deviant, immoral conduct. You know, gay people were thought of as perverts. They were viewed basically in the same way as, say, pedophiles are today. In fact, the two were often conflated. One of the sources of hostility that many people had to homosexuals in past times was that they thought that homosexuals sought to recruit into their ranks by molesting little boys and things like that. So homosexuals were often conflated with pedophiles. And certainly homosexuality was regarded as a deviant, immoral, you know, type of activity. And not just by very religious people, but by the wider society. This was a fairly common viewpoint. I guess probably the closest analogy to something like that today might be, sex between adults and underage people, not necessarily children, but more like these cases you see where a school teacher, you know, a 27-year-old school teacher is having sex with a 15 or 16-year-old pupil. That's considered certainly taboo and criminal as well. And homosexuality was considered criminal in past times. I mean, homosexuals were regularly sent to prison for years, you know, as felons back in the 1950s. And also, I think another correlation might be to drug use. I think the homosexuals basically had the same social and legal status in the 1950s as, say, a heroin user or cocaine user today, in the sense that what they're doing is considered a felony. They can be arrested. They can possibly do hard time in prison for it. So, that was the status of gay people legally and culturally back in the 1950s and early 60s. In fact, you know, when I used to teach sociology classes to undergraduates, I used to show them old police propaganda films from the early 60s depicting homosexuals as these crazed, demented deviants and that kind of thing. I used to show them that to show them, you know, the degree to which the status of gay people has been raised in our own society, and as well as how rapidly mores, social and cultural mores, can change over time. But over the past half of century, the perception of homosexuals or gay people or what are now called sexual minorities has certainly changed dramatically, in the sense that one reason for that has to do with just more effort by gay people to obtain greater rights for themselves. During the 60s and 70s, when you had this so-called rights revolution, that some commentators will call it, you know, there were, you know, racial minorities out there fighting for their rights, women's rights, and gay rights came out of that as well. And out of that, gay people started to become more politically active. They also started to become more publicly visible. More and more heterosexuals started to know someone personally who was openly gay. And that tended to have the effect of changing attitudes. The more exposure that heterosexuals had to openly homosexual people, the more they started to think, well, they're really not that much different than other people, in a general sense. So I think that a lot of the public sympathy for gay people in a lot of camps started to increase because, as well as greater activism by the gay rights movement. Also, there was a shift in the scientific understanding of homosexuality. If you go back and you look at medical textbooks and so forth from old past times, you'll see that homosexuality is typically regarded as a mental illness. That was the official position of the entire psychiatric industry, or the bulk of it at least, until the gay rights movement started to emerge. Since then, homosexuality has come to be viewed more as something that is not chosen, meaning that homosexuality is an immutable, innate condition, it's just like race, just like gender, just like physical disabilities and so forth, or other physical characteristics. And in many cases, at least, it's believed that homosexuals are born to be homosexuals. All of that is celebrated in the song by Lady Gaga, Born This Way, and some gays have taken that song up as an anthem. It clearly is true that there seems to be at least some categories. There may be different types of homosexuality. For example, there's situational homosexuality, like the kind you find in prisons, where there are people who engage in homosexual acts or relationships that probably wouldn't be doing that in some other context. But it's also true that certainly for hardcore male homosexuals, there does seem to be a genetic, a biological, or whatever hardwiring towards that orientation. So as the scientific understanding of what homosexuality is, as the scientific understanding has changed, social mores and as well as elite opinion and also popular opinion have started to change. So there's been a big shift in the culture in terms of how gay people are perceived for some of these reasons. Now, all of that leads to the cases that we saw before the Supreme Court this week. And the fact that these cases went before the Supreme Court shows just how far the gay rights movement has come and just how far the cultural revolution of the 60s and 70s has come. Back in the 1970s, the big issue for the gay rights movement was the repeal of sodomy laws, that is, laws that actually made homosexuality into a crime, as well as things like police brutality of gay people and harassment of gay bars and that kind of thing. Nowadays, that's not so much the issue as much as it's the gay rights movement is more about recognition of same-sex marriage and anti-discrimination law and that kind of thing. That led to these court cases that we had this week, and there were two court cases. The first one was Proposition 8, and this was a situation where in the state of California, a ballot initiative was put out, an initiative was put on the ballot, a referendum that would bar the state of California from recognizing same-sex marriages, and it passed. It passed by popular vote. Then the state courts in California struck down the results of that referendum, and their rationale for doing so was that individual rights are not subject to popular vote, and that equal protection under the law for minority groups is not subject to popular vote. And that by itself is a fairly sound principle of American jurisprudence. For example, it's certainly the case, it's widely established that you could not have a referendum, say, in the state of California to ban the Catholic Church because that would interfere with the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. Or you couldn't really have a referendum in the state of California to ban black people from the state because that would interfere with the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, what the Supreme Court, I mean, what the state courts in California did was apply that same principle to gay rights, saying that homosexuals are an identifiable class of minority persons, like racial minorities, and they are therefore entitled to equal protection under the law, under the 14th Amendment, and that marriage, according to various legal precedents, marriage is also considered a legal right for individuals, and that legal rights for individuals are not subject to majority vote. So that was the rationale that the state courts in California used to strike down Proposition 8. Now, whether you agree with that or whether you approve of that or whatever your issues on your views are on gay marriage, that's a separate question. But that was the legal rationale that the court used. And what happened was that the state government, the political branches of the state government of California, refused to challenge this court ruling, probably because they agreed with it. It's certainly true, I think, that in our own society, that elites, the political class, the educated classes, and so forth, have far more liberal views on social issues than ordinary people do. And I think that would probably be particularly true in California, the so-called blue state. All right, so probably the state government of California agreed with this decision, which is why they failed to challenge it. So what happened was that a private public interest group that opposed gay marriage went to the federal courts to try to challenge this case on various grounds. It was an abrogation of the democratic process, for example, by striking down a referendum. When it went to the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court actually ruled, they didn't rule in favor, for or against gay marriage per se. For example, in neither of these cases did the Supreme Court enact a Roe versus Wade of gay marriage, where they essentially required, Roe versus Wade required all of the 50 states to recognize the right to an abortion, and Lawrence versus Texas required all of the 50 states to recognize the right to engage in same-sex relationships. This case, the Proposition 8 case, the Perry case, was not as sweeping as that. What they did was they simply denied the challenge to the initial court ruling striking down Proposition 8 on technical grounds, which was lack of standing. What the Supreme Court said is that this private activist group that wanted to challenge this particular ruling had no legal standing on which to do so. They were not an authorized party to bring a suit of that type, which is fairly consistent with American law. I mean, they weren't just making up a legal precedent out of thin air. I mean, that really the legal precedents in American jurisprudence do indicate that there has to be to challenge a court decision in court, there has to be some legal standing by the party that is issuing the challenge. They have to either be litigants in the case or something like that. But the effect of the Supreme Court ruling regarding Proposition 8 is that it does de facto legalize same-sex marriage in California, because it upholds the state court decision that struck down Proposition 8. As of now, for all practical purposes, California is a gay marriage state as a result of this decision. Now, the other case, the case involving the Defense of Marriage Act, this was a case that was of a law enacted by Congress back during the Bill Clinton era that prohibits a number of different provisions, but the section of this law that was actually being challenged in front of the Supreme Court was a section that prohibited the federal government from granting benefits to same-sex couples in states where same-sex marriage is recognized, which basically means that according to this law, even if your same-sex marriage is recognized as legal in California or Massachusetts or Hawaii or Iowa or Vermont or somewhere wherever they have this, that doesn't mean you can write off your same-sex marital partner on your taxes as a dependent spouse or claim your same-sex partner as a beneficiary of Social Security or something like that. It really has to do with the gist of it is the degree to which same-sex marriages interact with the welfare state and the provisions of the welfare state, as well as things like tax law and there's some issues involving immigration law and some other stuff. So that's really the part of this law, the Defense of Marriage Act, that was being challenged in court. And the Defense of Marriage Act was by no means universally popular on the right. There are some constitutional conservatives that argued that marital law, period, should be a matter for the states to decide for themselves, and that the federal government should not have any prerogative as to what should be considered a valid marriage. That's a state's issue. Some constitutionalists were arguing that. For example, that was Ron Paul's position. I think that's Rand Paul's position as well. But with the Defense of Marriage Act, when this, you know, when that went in front of the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, or at least this particular part of it, on the grounds that denying same-sex couples the benefits that married couples would normally get under federal law, even if their marriage is recognized as valid in their own state, that in and of itself violated the equal protection laws of the 14th Amendment, or the clause of the 14th Amendment, which upholds equal protection under the law. So it's really the same basic basis as what the Supreme Court, or as what the state courts in California had previously ruled. So both of these rulings are landmark rulings for the gay rights movement. And I would predict that it's merely a stepping stone towards more radical rulings in favor of gay rights. For example, I expect that the Supreme Court will eventually legalize gay marriage nationwide. Eventually, there will be a Roe versus Wade of gay marriage, where all of the 50 states are essentially required to recognize same-sex marriage. And that will probably happen at some point in the future. But what's most interesting about this case is the degree of public drama associated with these cases, these two cases. That gets us to the question of what are the real issues involved with this question of same-sex marriage. I think there's a number of them. First of all, I don't think it's really the question of marriage itself. You know, it's not. I don't think the real issue here is whether a gay couple, a same-sex couple, can go to a judge and get a marriage license and get legally married. I don't think that, you know, there are certainly some social conservatives and some religious fundamentalists who would view that as an abomination unto itself. There are certainly some very conservative cultural elements who would view that in that way. But I don't really think that's the real crux of the issue for most people. Rather, I think that on both the gay rights side and on the anti-gay marriage side, there are other issues involved on a number of different levels. On a more practical level, I think for the gay rights movement, it really does in many instances come down to the kind that gays want for their relationships, the same kind of legal benefits that heterosexual married couples have. You know, things involving tax policy and immigration policy and welfare policy and things like that. I mean, if you ask gay rights activists, if you talk to them, you know, and I've done that myself, I've asked them, you know, why are you so big on gay marriage? They will tell you that, but the benefits that are associated with that in a legal, economic, and so context. I think on the conservative side, one of the main reasons that they are so opposed on a practical level to gay marriage has to do with the issue of religious freedom. I think they're concerned that if gay marriage is legalized and recognized, that the next step will be that religious institutions will be prohibited from failing to recognize gay marriage. For example, religious colleges will be required to recognize gay rights organizations as legitimate student organizations, even if something like that goes against the teachings of the particular religion that this Christian or whatever college was set up to promote. Or I think that they're concerned that religious-oriented businesses would be required to hire homosexuals, you know, like a religious bookstore or something like that. Or I think they're concerned about lawsuits being brought against, say, a private religious school that refused to hire a homosexual teacher, issues of this type. I think they're worried about religious discrimination, or they're worried about freedom of association on the basis of religion and religious freedom of religious practice being imposed, a type of religious discrimination being imposed in the name of curbing discrimination against gay people. So I think that's the real issue there. You know, what role will gay rights play when it comes to private institutions and to religious institutions? You know, as well as things like public spending, you know, to the degree to which, say, same-sex couples are eligible for, you know, welfare state-oriented benefits and that kind of thing, and the degree to which the state should actually subsidize same-sex relationships. And, you know, those are the issues that social conservatives and religious conservatives will typically raise. So those are some of the practical issues involved. But much more so than these practical issues, you know, I don't think that the issues I just discussed on both sides are really what motivates most people who have so much concern about this issue of gay marriage. For instance, well, on the gay side, there's no evidence that the majority of gay people have any interest in getting married. The Netherlands, Holland, was the first country to legalize gay marriage, to fully legalize gay marriage. And gay marriage has been legal there for something like 12 or 13 years. And to date, less than 20% of gay couples have actually gotten married legally in Holland. So in the world's most, arguably the world's most liberal country, the first country to establish legally recognized gay marriage, you know, more than a decade later, still only a relatively small minority, only about 1 in 5 of gay couples have actually gotten married. So it's not like there's going to be armies of people out there who's seeking to marry someone of the same sex if gay marriage is legalized. Certainly most heterosexuals have no interest in marrying someone of the same sex, or no heterosexuals. And the majority of gay people seem to have no interest in marrying someone of the same sex. And also, from the other side, while there are certainly some religious conservatives who were concerned about their religious freedom and institutional liberties and free associational liberties and privacy rights and so forth, it's also true that most people are not religious fundamentalists. You know, most people are not people who have strong religious objections to same-sex marriage. The evidence is clear that the religious conservatives, broadly defined, are shrinking in size relative to the wider population. Their political influence is certainly declining. That's particularly true among younger people. So that's not really the big issue there either, the main issue. I think that the real issue behind the furor over gay marriage, the fact that this is something that so many people seem to think is so important, even though the practical issues involved in it tend to be fairly marginal in nature, or at least or affect only a fairly small number of people, I think that the real issue is what gay marriage symbolizes to both sides, to both sides of the controversy. I think to the left, this issue, more than any other issue, symbolizes the victory of the Cultural Revolution that came out of the 60s and 70s. I think there are a lot of people on the left end of the spectrum who look at it like, boy, if we can get this passed, if we can get homosexual marriages enacted, then we've really come a long way. This really indicates victory for our side. Likewise, I think there are plenty of conservatives who look at this and say, wow, if homosexual marriages are legalized, well, that shows we really are on the losing end of the culture wars and the wider conflict between the traditional WASP-oriented society and then the cultural radicalism that came out of the 60s and 70s. So I think both for both sides, the symbolic value of this is far more important than its practical value. Because the same-sex marriage to date is probably the most radical or most extreme achievement of the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s, more so than legalizing abortion, more so than the revolution in civil rights regarding race, more so than simply repealing laws that criminalize same-sex relationships. I think to date, legal recognition of same-sex marriage, more than anything else, is the most radical, most extreme, by traditional standards, achievement of the Cultural Revolution of the 1670s. And I think that is why both sides have such intense emotion and such intense feeling about this, even though the practical aspects of this are fairly negligible. Now, one thing that I also think is interesting is that among many younger people, it's become the case that being in favor of same-sex marriage is a sign of being hip. It's a sign of being cool. It's a sign of being progressive. To be against same-sex marriage is to be old-fashioned and square or uncool or whatever you would call it nowadays. And I think it's interesting to examine the question of why that is the case, and I think the reason for it is fairly obvious. I think that while in our own society, the ideological values, the cultural values of the political class tend to be mixed. Certainly the ideological values of the business class tends to be mixed. The ideological values of the wider society tends to be mixed. It's also true that the institutions that really inculcate and disseminate cultural values and cultural norms and ideological values, which in our society are the media and the educational system, it's clear that those two institutions, the media and educational system, tend at present to be dominated by the left, or certainly opinions that are far to the left of center. Right. And I think that there has been often a conscious or certainly unconscious or subtle effort by the left to use its influence in these sectors, in these cultural institutions, to promote views that are favorable to things like gay rights and so forth. You know, for example, when I was in college in the 90s as an undergrad, And really before that, even I was in college off and on for years in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s as well. But I know that it was not uncommon for in classes and undergrad level classes in social science classes and so forth to have guest speakers come in and representatives of gay rights organizations and to talk about their experiences and that kind of thing. And clearly the purpose of that is for students to receive a favorable impression of the gay rights movement, of gay people generally, and so forth. And I'm not necessarily criticizing that or making any value judgment about that, but what I am saying is that if you look at the content of television programs, of movies, as well as the content of curriculum in schools, particularly universities, you do see that the left-of-center opinion on these kinds of issues is very much the dominant one. And so I think that explains to a large degree why younger people now seem to have this view that, well, being for gay marriage and same-sex marriage and all that is a sign of being cool and progressive and hip and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not making any value judgment about that either, but I'm just trying to explain a cultural phenomena, a sociological phenomena. Now, an even bigger question is, what does this issue represent in terms of the future of American society, American culture, American politics, and American jurisprudence in the realm of law? While, as I said earlier, it has certainly been the case that conservatives have been successful in stacking the federal judiciary with Republican appointees, their long-term goal of rolling back the Cultural Revolution will not happen. It simply will not happen. It hasn't happened yet. The fact that the judiciary has been dominated by conservatives for a couple of decades now or more may have slowed down the progress of the Cultural Revolution in law, but it hasn't necessarily slowed it down in the wider society. And I think that what will happen is that, however liberal or conservative the courts may be concerning these kinds of laws and laws related to these kinds of issues, eventually the law itself will be overrun by the wider society. That is, the changes that are continuing to go on in the wider society in terms of demographics, in terms of culture, in terms of generational change, in terms of political trends generally, in terms of economic trends, all of that indicates that the cultural left will unquestionably be the winner in these culture war issues, and already is the winner for the most part. And if the a judiciary that is resistant to that continues to remain in place, it will eventually be overrun. And what I mean by that is that the federal judges have a lifetime appointment, as do Supreme Court justices, but lifetimes don't last forever. Most federal judges, certainly Supreme Court justices, tend to be late middle-aged to elderly people, right? And they're going to die off eventually and retire. And I think the evidence is clear that the left-of-center perspective, the Democratic Party and all that, will dominate the electoral process for the foreseeable future. Yes, the Republicans may win an election, they may get a president here and there, but for the most part, the left is going to dominate the electoral process for the foreseeable future, probably a several more decades at least, which means that future judicial appointees at the federal level in particular are going to be appointees of the left and are going to much more greatly reflect the values of the left. For example, most Supreme Court justices who are appointed in the future, most federal judges that are appointed in the future are going to be much more in the vein of someone like Alina Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor than they're going to be like, say, Clarence Thomas or Antonin Scalia. So as the left continues to dominate the political process just through the wider changes in the society, so will the left come to reclaim control over the judiciary. And the conservatives will start to recede. The influence of conservative jurists will start to recede. Now, as for the impact that will have on American society, I think there's something very important to consider. And to my knowledge, I am the only person, the only candidate, the only commentator, rather, that has raised this issue of what impact will the left, as it currently stands, have on the judiciary as it gets to dominate the judiciary more and more. I think it's certainly the case that as the left dominates the political process and as the content of the judiciary starts to continually move further leftward, and the gains of conservatives during the Reagan era, during the George W. Bush era in the judiciary are undone, I think it's important to recognize that the left that will dominate the judiciary in the future will not be the same kind of left that dominated the judiciary in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s. It will not be that kind of a left. It will not be the old-fashioned civil libertarian liberal left. And there's a number of reasons why I say this. When I was younger, and this was in the 70s and 80s, the left in those days was somewhat different, often much different than what we see today. The left, as I knew it when I was younger, when I was a teenager, you know, or an early 20-something, the left back then was basically an outgrowth of the Vietnam War era. It was generally opposed to American intervention overseas in other countries. For example, the war in Central America that was going on at the time. The left tended to side with the poor and the working class on economic issues. You know, there was pro-labor union, pro-expansion of social programs for the poor. You know, whatever you think of those per se, I mean, as policies, I do think that the left of that time was sincerely on the side of the poor and working class, whatever you think of some of their proposed solutions to problems. The left in those days tended to certainly be for equal rights for everyone, you know, racial minorities, women, gay people, et cetera. And the left also tended to have a high regard for individual rights. You had the groups like the American Civil Liberties Union, while a very left-leaning group, would still uphold civil liberties for everyone that came under attack by the state. They would defend the free speech rights for neo-Nazis. They actually defended Oliver North, of all people, when his Fifth Amendment rights were violated, when he was prosecuted for perjury because of his testimony in front of Congress. So the civil libertarian left was fairly prevalent and fairly influential. And it was this left, it was this kind of left that I'm describing now, that tended to dominate the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary during the 1960s and 70s. And it was this kind of thinking that led to some of these landmark rulings for individual rights and the rights of minority groups and so forth. I don't really see that kind of thinking on the left nowadays. I think that probably starting sometime in the 80s, when the radicals of the 60s started to really become dominant in first in educational institutions and then in subsequent institutions, you know, that as that dominance has spread into other institutions generally, I think that there was a shift in the thinking of the left on a lot of these kinds of questions. The left as it was in past times, the left as it was in, say, the 70s, early 80s, the liberal left, tended to be somewhat within the tradition of classical liberalism, that is, and a liberalism that's about individual rights, you know, the kind of stuff you see in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Plus some, you know, socialist or quasi-socialist or progressive ideas about social justice for the working class and that kind of stuff. That's what the left was during the era of some of these landmark Supreme Court decisions upholding individual rights in the 60s and 70s. It was this kind of hybrid of classical liberalism plus, you know, progressive liberalism. The left since then has taken a sharp turn away from that. And the left of today tends to have a much more, at least implicitly, Marxist influence, a much more implicitly Marxist conception of what freedom is, in the sense that freedom is not about individuality and individual rights or freedom from the state or institutional authority. Rather, freedom has to do with class power and the power of classes and groups within the state. And freedom is about the right to things, more of a positivist conception of freedom. And you see that in the prevailing values on the left as it is today. What I have noticed repeatedly in my countless encounters with leftists, you know, and I'm talking about knowing plenty of these people. I don't just make this stuff up. When I criticize the left like I do, I don't just make this stuff up. I'm not just theorizing about it. I'm basing most of this on my own experiences with the left, being a part of the radical left political subculture for years, knowing lots of radical leftists from my involvement in the academic world, as well as reading their literature and so forth. The left today tends to be much more oriented towards a type of identity politics that reflects, in some ways, a type of crude tribalism. It's, you know, it's all about promoting demographic conflict between, you know, blacks and whites and men and women and gays and straights and getting even with the oppressor class. You see a lot of that kind of thinking and this kind of identity politics oriented leftism that, in some ways, ironically, mirrors that of what you see on the far right. The same kind of victimology and getting even with the class enemy or the racial enemy or the gender enemy and that kind of thing. You also see on the left today the prevalence of therapeutic values about how health is a primary issue, and it's fine to curtail the liberties of individuals in order to advance this wider paradigm of health, you know, which is in some ways conjures up images of the eugenics movement and things like that from the early 20th century. This fixation on health, for instance, you see that in the obsession with smoking. You know, most old style liberals, I think, probably wouldn't have cared if people smoked in bars. You know, they may have said, well, no, it's not good to smoke in hospitals where there's, you know, patients with lung diseases around and things like that. But I can't really imagine the liberal left as it was in the 70s, you know, giving a damn about whether people smoke in a bar or not or something like that. You back in those days, you didn't really have this kind of therapeutic moralism that you do now, this obsession with health. In fact, you had a lot of people on the left that day that obviously, in those days, that obviously could have cared less about health, given some of the lifestyle issues involved. But we do, that is something we see now. We see the therapeutic values, and not just in terms of physical health, like the obsession with smoking and fatty foods and salt and that kind of stuff, but also in a more psychotherapeutic sense. You have people that saying that they feel oppressed if somebody disagrees with them or criticizes them and or is insensitive towards them. We see a lot of that kind of thinking on the left today as well, as far as therapeutic values go. And beyond these therapeutic values, beyond these identity politics, we also see in the realm of environmentalism, we see a type of environmentalism that's almost religious in nature. Now, of course, most reasonable people would agree that we need clean air, we need clean drinking water, we need healthy food. You know, nobody wants to eat food that was, you know, had rat droppings fall into it when it was being processed. Most reasonable people would think that, yeah, it's fine to try to preserve endangered species, you know, panda bears and spotted owls. Yeah, it's good to keep those around. So it's good to have some wilderness left. You know, we don't want to have the whole world is just one big shopping mall. That's not, so I'm not bashing environmentalism per se, but within the ranks of the environmental left, I do see a lot of thinking that's almost religious in nature, in the sense it's really just about nature worship. It's really not about, you know, preserving the environment to meet human needs or even in an aesthetic sense. It's more just the environment is a means unto itself. And, you know, if human beings or, for that matter, animals have to die off to preserve the environment, well, so be it. Almost a type of pantheism, nature worship, you know, almost like something like the Hare Krishnas or a sect like that would believe. And some of this stuff gets fairly extreme. I've known a number of people who were into this kind of thing, and some of it is really way out there. And I see that kind of thing becoming more influential on the left. Beyond that, of course, there's the left's ongoing orientation towards the state. While there's certainly an anti-statist strand to the left, overwhelmingly the dominant strands on the left tend to be very state-centric, and they see the state as a manifestation of society, and the state is like this, you know, sugar mama that gives us all kinds of goodies. And I also think that the class dynamics of the left have shifted, in that the left today isn't so much about social justice for the poor and working class. It's more of a middle-class-oriented left, and while they may be in favor of the welfare state, they're in favor of it because it provides jobs to themselves as public sector bureaucrats, and, you know, they want the, you know, a socialized health care system and preserve middle-class entitlements that, like Social Security and Medicare and so forth. That's really where the left is today. I mean, the left today is not the old-fashioned, you know, civil libertarian, liberal/progressive left. It's not the counterculture left from the 60s and 70s. It's all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll and hedonism and so forth. No, the left today is a middle class oriented, therapeutic, tribalistic, moralistic left. that really has very little regard for individual rights or individual freedom. And I think that as the left in the future comes to dominate the judiciary, this is what the judicial left will be. It won't be the Supreme Court that we had in the 60s and 70s with people like William O. Douglas and William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall and old-fashioned liberal civil libertarians. It'll be a judiciary that is dominated by people that believe in using the state to promote radical egalitarianism, radical environmentalism, radical therapeutic values without any regard at all for individual rights. And it turns its back on the liberal tradition on which a lot of in which a lot of American jurisprudence has its roots. So, in other words, you know, wherever you stand on the political spectrum, left or right, while there's certainly plenty of things about the conservative-oriented judiciary, dominated judiciary that we have today that are worth criticizing, when the left reclaims dominance, as it will in another generation or so, I don't think that that will necessarily be anything to celebrate from the point of view of someone who is pro-freedom and liberty. And I think that that really is the most important issue involved in this question of same-sex marriage, in that it's not so much about individual rights. It's not simply about the right of gay people to get married in a legal sense. It's more about advancing this wider paradigm of what I call totalitarian humanism. I mean, I don't think that gay marriage by itself is a manifestation of, or let alone gay people, or a manifestation of totalitarian humanism. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the political interest groups that are most adamant about enacting gay marriage are, in fact, what part of this wider totalitarian humanist paradigm, which sees the state as their friend, and which is to advance statism in a lot of different realms. I know John Whitehead, who is a constitutional attorney, a civil libertarian. Ironically, he used to be a leading figure on the religious right back in the early days of the religious right. He's since done an about face and become something of a radical civil libertarian. Based on bad experiences in part that he had during his time on the religious right. But John Whitehead argues that this Supreme Court that we have today is arguably one of the most statist in history. And if you look at some of the cases that were in front of the Supreme Court this time, there were a lot of very important cases. There were cases involving a lot of rights of citizens and encounters with the police, Miranda issues, Fourth Amendment issues, and so forth. There were racially charged issues like those involving the Voting Rights Act, those involving affirmative action. There was at least one case involving the surveillance state. There was a lot of issues involving business law and so forth. And the votes of the Supreme Court on most of those cases, the rulings of the Supreme Court in most of those cases veered slightly rightward. Maybe not radically rightward, but slightly rightward. Right. It was primarily on the gay marriage cases where the left end of the spectrum got the upper hand, and those are the cases that everyone is talking about and discussing. In fact, it's interesting to observe that the Supreme Court cases involving gay marriage have gotten a lot more attention from both the media and from the general public than the revelations that Edward Snowden brought forth about the surveillance state. There's more people out there who care about gay marriage than there are people who care about the surveillance state. And I think that says a lot about our society and where people are thinking. I think that it's really interesting to observe how our society is made up of people who are arguing about these symbolic issues like gay marriage, while the state itself continues to consolidate its own power, and as class divisions continue to widen, as Big Brother government becomes ever more expansive, as civil liberties generally continue to recede. That's really interesting, and we're going to see more of that in the future. In the future, as the left reclaims the judiciary, it's going to be a different kind of left. It's not going to be the liberal civil libertarian left. It's not going to be the hippie counterculture left. It's going to be the therapeutic PC moralistic, middle-class-oriented left, and it's going to be a left that has political dominance within the context of this wider imperialist, plutocratic, police state paradigm that the conservatives and liberals alike have put into place over the past few decades. And that's what we're going to be up against in the future. You know, those of us that attack the system and our allied groups and other groups that we're trying to connect with, that's what we're going to be up against. That's going to be the political class of the future. That's going to be the judiciary of the future. That's going to be the dominant culture of the future. And it's up to us to build a resistance movement that will challenge all of these things. And, you know, of course, the kind of anarchist movement that I envision for some point in the future that will mount a challenge to the emerging imperialist, plutocratic, totalitarian, humanist police state would probably in many ways resemble the old-fashioned liberal, civil, libertarian, you know, hippie counterculture left as it was in the 60s and 70s, minus the influence of the cultural Marxists. In the sense that, yeah, we would certainly uphold civil rights and civil liberties for, you know, drug users and people perceived of as sexual deviants and all kinds of groups that some of these older forms of leftism tended to champion. And at the same time, you know, we might do what the ACLU would do, and that is defend people on the right end of the spectrum who come under attack by the state. I think it's essential that we have a movement, an anti-state movement, a libertarian movement, and an anarchist movement that defends free speech rights for everyone, that defends free association rights for everyone, that defends cultural freedom for everyone, you know, from religious conservatives and racialists on the right to sexual deviants and drug users and so forth on the left and everything in between. And if you delve deep into some of my own writings, you see that I take a fairly radical position on some of these things. And that's, I find it really interesting that that's an aspect of my own work that tends to be ignored, particularly by critics. You know, a lot of my critics from the left will try to portray me as a type of neo-fascist or neo-Nazi sympathizer or some right-wing extremist, which is hardly the case at all. I mean, the far right aspects of my own thinking or outreach activities are actually a small percentage of everything that I do. If you delve deep into my writings, you see that I advocate organizing and doing outreach to all sorts of marginalized, disadvantaged, you know, lower socioeconomic sectors that, you know, have nothing to do with the right in any conventional sense. Everything from, you know, street gangs to prison inmates to, you know, drug users and prostitutes and the mentally ill and all sorts of outlandish religious cults and so forth. You know, I'm really for defending everyone that comes under attack by the state all across the spectrum. And, of course, with our long-term goal of anarcho-pluralism or pan-anarchism or whatever we want to call it as an alternative political system, you know, that's necessary to our wider strategy. We need to go out and defend everyone that comes under attack by the state. And then once the state recedes, we are free to organize whatever kinds of communities we want for those who think like we do. And within that context, you could have a liberal community that's very oriented towards recognizing same-sex marriage or other issues that contemporary leftists get into. You could also have a very conservative community that practices some fairly conservative values. And you do see subcultures like that or private institutions like that even in the current society. So that's what our paradigm needs to be. Our paradigm needs to be about defending all those who come under attack by the system from the system. And if we look carefully, we see what we're going to be up against in the future is this plutocratic imperialist police state that is culturally and legally dominated by a type of therapeutic, moralistic, identity politics-driven leftism that's very middle-class, bourgeois-oriented, but is also thoroughly integrated along racial and gender and sexual and cultural lines. That's going to be the other side of the spectrum if our movement ever goes anywhere, which is what we're trying to do. So until then, this has been Keith Preston for Attack the System, and I'll be back next week with another program covering some more issues. Meanwhile, feel free to tune in to our weekly podcast here. Feel free to check out our website at attackthesystem.com. Feel free to contribute financially if you feel that that's worth doing and you're able to do so. Donations are always welcome. What I would like to see happen eventually is I'd like to be able to do these programs on a daily basis. I'd like to be able to have more programs on Attack the System of this type, not just with me, but with other people and covering a wider variety of topics. I'd like to have get more into video and the use of video. Unfortunately, that kind of thing takes time. It takes money. It takes professional quality people to produce some of that kind of work, and that's why we need support. Also, check out our Facebook pages. Attack the System has a Facebook page. Also, American Revolutionary Vanguard has a Facebook page. You can check out my personal Facebook page, Keith Preston. Feel free to contact us. Post comments on the website. Post comments on the Facebook pages. Contact me personally if you'd wish through the Facebook page, on Facebook or on the website, and keep following Attack the System and delve deep into some of our articles, our core documents, as we call them, that are on the website. I think you'll find a lot of interesting ideas. In fact, many of you who are listening to this who are opposed to what we do at Attack the System, and I know that there are people who listen to this program who read the website who are very opposed to what we do. Delve deep into some of our articles, some of our writings, and see what's really there. I think that a lot of our critics tend to approach what we do with closed minds, and they just see buzzwords or they just see symbols that they have an adverse reaction to, or they're going by what other people have said about us. So keep an open mind and take a look at some of this, and make your own decisions. And until then, I'll check you later. This is Keith Preston at Attack the System. Have a good week.